I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Oh, what a week. Why don't we all feel a little more bailed out? Or is it rescued? In a moment, Steven Pinker on parsing all the bad news we're hearing. But let's start with the news. President Bush addressed the nation today after the Dow Jones yesterday dropped below 9,000 points, putting an exclamation point on the end of the worst 7 days on Wall Street since the market was created 112 years ago. The president aimed for reassurance.
The plan we are executing is aggressive. It is the right plan. It will take time to have its full impact. It is flexible enough to adapt as the situation changes, and it is big enough to work.
The president mentioned key measures the government has taken, the bailout bill, raising the limit on insured bank deposits to $250,000, cutting key interest rates, and working with homeowners to avoid foreclosure. There are other plans on the table, but where are we in this tailspin? Well, Jesse Eisinger of Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine joins us. And Jesse, President Bush didn't really have anything concrete to say. Is his appearance at this point, you know, good or bad for the market?
I think it's irrelevant to bad, unfortunately. I don't think that the president has much credibility with the American public and certainly not with the market. So I think his appearance is counterproductive at best. I don't think that this was moving the markets any way at any point particularly, but I don't think it helped.
Well, we wonder why he didn't mention, first of all, that he's meeting with G8 leaders this weekend. What would come out of those talks?
Well, there is some discussion now that there's going to be a coordinated effort to take equity stakes in banks, that governments around the world would follow what the UK has already done and is under consideration in the United States.
In other words, buy into banks instead of buying up bad assets, infuse cash into the banks by, buying into them.
Exactly. Taking stock in some form or other in banks. And therefore, what they could do with this money is go out and actually lend it. If you just buy the asset, you're replacing $1 of assets, and you'd really have to overpay for those assets to help the banks out. But if you actually bought stock, they could use those dollars to create multiple loans, multiple dollars worth of loans, $8 to $10 worth of loans.
Right.
So you get more bang for your buck.
Thaw out this credit freeze. Well, Congress last week increased the amount of FDIC insurance that bank deposits can be insured from $100,000 to $250,000, so they've raised that level. But is there speculation that the limit will be lifted altogether to insure all deposits, no matter what amount?
Well, there's some talk that the federal government might backstop all bank liabilities and be insure deposits. The deposits are not the crux of the problem here. Banks are not failing because of bank runs, because depositors are leaving the banks particularly. Mm-hmm. The problem is that banks are not lending to each other, that we have a crisis in the credit markets where banks don't want to lend out any money to companies or to each other, and nobody knows how many bad loans they're sitting on, and the other banks are sitting on. So there's this deep uncertainty here. So the FDIC raising its limit, that does something for confidence, but it's really not the crux of the problem.
Well, and we know Congress, especially the Democratic leadership, is talking about another stimulus package, cutting checks and sending them to the Americans in the hopes that they'll spend them. But you say that we may have to just massively realign the economy. Right now the economy is dominated by sales and financial services, and we have to go back to making things. I mean, but that's pretty long range.
We're in for a very significant, long-range, difficult economic time. I think everyone now understands we're in a recession, and the debate now is how long this recession is going to be and whether we can stave off depression. It's crazy and practically unthinkable to even say that word, but I think it's now on the table as a possibility. I think we'll stave it off because we know what the problems were that led to the Great Depression, and I think that one of the things that the government did incorrectly in the 30s was tighten up credit and stop spending. And so what we'll do is the government will spend a lot of money. It's going to give people checks to go out and spend. It's going to have works projects, infrastructure projects, things like that. I think that's all going to develop over the next year or so to try to get us out of the problem or to try to curtail this recession. Right. But, yes, we've been living beyond our means, and now we're paying the piper.
Jesse Eisinger of Condé Nast Portfolio, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, between the financial crisis and the presidential campaign, we've been reminded of how much weight words carry. The bailout bill became the rescue plan. We also had the fundamentals of the economy, drill, baby drill, lipstick on a pig. And how about how we say words? People were asking, is Sarah Palin, who grew up in Alaska, maybe really from Minnesota? She sounds like it. We want to talk language and words, and that will make our next guest very happy. In his latest book, he refers to verbs as his little friends. Steven Pinker is a professor of psychology at Harvard and author of several books. His latest is The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. And Steven, let's touch on that question about Sarah Palin. You wrote an op-ed piece after the vice presidential debate where you said, well, it makes sense that Sarah Palin sounds like she's from the fictional movie Fargo.
Yeah, it sounds like she's going to tell us to step away from the wood chipper any minute. And I couldn't figure this out. From the moment of the Republican National Convention, I was trying to figure out where that accent came from. But then I found the missing piece of the puzzle, which is the Matsu Valley, where she grew up, was settled by Minnesotan farmers who were relocated there during the Great Depression. Kind of like it's cold in Minnesota, cold in Alaska. They won't know the difference. Let's move them up to Alaska. And so they did bring the Minnowegian dialect with them.
Well, of course you looked all that up. Ladies and gentlemen, Steven Pinker, because that's how much you care about words and how we hear them, how we speak them. And so completing your thought in the op-ed piece, you were saying it's not how she spoke in that debate that was important. In fact, you said that was a red herring, by the way, a metaphor. We're going to touch on metaphors in a moment. But it was what actually happened in that debate.
Yes. I think there are two things that people noticed from her speech style in general and that debate in particular. One of them are quirks of pronunciation that I think are red herrings. Nuclear sets people's teeth on edge, and they assume that it's a sign of ignorance or stupidity. And the reason it's not a big deal is it's actually pretty common to switch around a vowel and a vowel-like consonant. Mm-hmm. We do it when we say things like jewelry instead of jewelry, right. And it's happened throughout the history of the English language. Bird was originally brid. Horse was originally hross.
Really?
If you go back far enough in history. And throughout the United States, in the South and the West, you often hear the nuclear pronunciation.
But your point in the op-ed was that it's more about what was actually said, exchanges that took place. They were like non sequiturs.
Yes. I think there were two things that really were legitimate causes for concern. One of them was that she avoided answering questions. In the format of that debate, where you had the questioner down on the floor 30 feet away, and you're at a podium staring at a camera, and the camera can't make faces if you start to go off topic, you can just press the talking point button and spew out any old non sequitur, and it's not as jarring as it would be in a one-on-one conversation.
Well, you did something really wonderful in this op-ed to drive home this point. Instead of it being Sarah Palin and the moderator, you made it someone named Lisa and someone named Michael. And let's have you and I read one of these exchanges, okay? And Lisa says, how about that bailout? Was this Washington at its best or at its worst?
You know, I think a good barometer here, as we try to figure out, has this been a good time or a bad time in America's economy, is to go to a kid's soccer game on Saturday and turn to any parent there on the sideline and ask them, how are you feeling about the economy?
I should say, you know, when you put it this way, those were Sarah Palin's exact words.
That was the exchange, actually. Or to go to a kid's soccer game, I do the Minnowegian.
Why is it that, as Americans, we've come to accept that this is actual dialogue that people are having?
Well, for one thing, we kind of force politicians into this empty mode of speech, because what a lot of the media coverage of presidential politics consists of is waiting for the gaffe. Now, what is a gaffe? My favorite definition comes from Michael Kinsley. A gaffe in Washington is when a politician says something that is true. Now, if that is what political media coverage consists of, it forces the politicians to say as little as possible, not to commit to raise taxes, even though it's obvious that there's going to have to be some kind of tax increase so that we're not horribly in debt. As soon as you say it, then it gets replayed over and over again. So what do you do if you're a rational politician? You don't say it. Or you engage in what's sometimes called dog whistle rhetoric. Namely, you say something in a pitch that's too high for most people to hear, except a constituency that is attuned to that frequency, and you communicate to them using code words that only they know are code words.
Which brings us to frames and metaphors. Anti-tax activists frame the estate tax on the wealthy as the death tax, so people think it affects them when it doesn't. You say that day-to-day political debates are contests between these frames and metaphors, and you call linguist George Lakoff the messiah of metaphors.
Well, George Lakoff has shown quite convincingly and strikingly how filled with metaphor our everyday language is. An example, I just said filled with metaphor, as if language is a container and the various tropes we use in language are contents, like a bunch of marbles in a can. Lakoff points out brilliantly that it's almost impossible not to speak in metaphor. You can't talk about an argument without using expressions like, I tried to win the argument, but I always lose, so I attacked his point, he tried to defend it this way or that way. And we're bringing in all of these images from war in talking about verbal disputation. We can't get around it.
But Lakoff has said that frames, you know, framing things using metaphors, trump facts. And he suggested that Democrats use frames and metaphors the way that Republicans do. For instance, Lakoff has said, and you write about this in your book, reframe taxes as membership fees. You say what to that?
I think if any politician tried to describe taxes as membership fees, he would be fodder for Leno and Letterman and O'Brien forever. He would be a laughingstock of politics. So I think just as pure tactical advice, it's not advisable. But also, and here's where I do disagree with George Lakoff, I think it's a little bit too cynical to say, as he does, that frames trump facts, that people just, that there's no such thing as objective reality, that all you have in political discourse is really a beauty contest between rival frames. I think he is right that we communicate in these metaphors without even realizing it, that a lot of argumentation consists not only of disputing facts, but often of trying to frame the same thing in different ways. Pro-life versus pro-choice. Killing an incipient human versus destroying a blastocyst right. for research purposes. Nonetheless, I don't think we're confined to just haggling over whose frame sticks in people's brains. I think we can go beneath the frame and examine the merits of particular positions. And taxes are not membership fees. If you are part of an organization and you stop paying your fees, then the organization no longer extends you the benefits. You can't go to the gym and use their equipment if you don't pay the monthly fees to the gym. If you don't pay your taxes, men with guns will put you in jail. Membership fees and taxes are really different things, and just using one as a euphemism for the other is, I think, not an effective political tactic.
As Steven Pinker, professor of psychology at Harvard, his latest book, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature, is just out in paperback. When we come back, why he thinks the question of whether President Bush lied about Saddam Hussein's search for nuclear material turns in part on the president's use of one verb, learn. Also later, we'll check in on the shifting political landscape in the battleground states of Wisconsin and Ohio. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with linguist and Harvard professor Steven Pinker. Before the break, we were talking about how we see things through frames. You know, one person's war of liberation is another's unjust invasion. But Steven, you have two fascinating examples of how we get at the truth. The first is about the now infamous 16 words that President Bush said in a State of the Union address. He said, "The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa." Now, the British government went on to say months later that they did not believe that was true, but at the time they thought it was. And this was part of the proof that at the time the White House offered that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. We now know, of course, he didn't. You say that whether or not President Bush lied in that statement depends on the verb learned.
Yes, it's a subtle distinction, but I think it's one that we all recognize. So, for example, when Mark Twain said, I used to remember things whether they happened or not, but now I've gotten old and I can only remember the things that didn't happen. You can't remember something that didn't happen. You can think you remember something that didn't happen, but remember is what linguists call a factive verb. That is, when you use it, you're committing yourself to the truth of what it is that that verb is about. Right. Now, learn is a word like that. When you use the word learn, you are saying that the thing that so-and-so learned actually is true. So right. If Bush said British intelligence has learned that Saddam tried to obtain uranium, Bush was committing himself to the assumption that Saddam did try to obtain uranium.
Could the Bush administration say, well, we're no Steven Pinker. we didn't know that was a factive word.
Well, I think the fact that people can recognize that John knows that Dewey defeated Truman is a weird sentence. You can say John thinks that Dewey defeated Truman, but you can't use know that way. You can't use remember that way. You can't use learn that way.
There's another example that you give of the importance of just one word. It's also a grim reminder of 9/11. It's the trial that took place to determine if the attack on the U.S. on 9/11, masterminded by Osama bin Laden, was one event or two. And this discussion took place to determine if the insurance payout to the man who held the leases on the World Trade Towers was going to be for one or two events. He'd bought insurance of up to $3.5 billion against a destructive event, but if it was more than one event, well, then he'd get $7 billion. Lay that out for us.
Well, I had this challenge. Here I was writing a book on semantics, and as soon as you say that, people say, oh, semantics, that's just, you know, hair splitting. That's angels can dance on the head of a pin. How could anyone be interested in a book on semantics? So on an example where semantics, which is really the way the human mind construes reality, it's not trivial, it's not hair splitting. I wanted an example where semantics really mattered. In fact, where you could put a dollar value on semantics. And the fact that if 9/11 was one event, the leaseholder was going to gain $3.5 billion. If it was two events, he was going to gain $7 billion. It wasn't a dispute on the facts, it was a dispute on the construal of the facts, one event versus two. The way the mind construes events can use either physical change. A building gets hit, another building gets hit, 1 plus 1 equals 2. Or it can use human goals. Osama bin Laden had a plan. The plan was carried out, one event. And physical change versus human goal are two of the big conceptual distinctions that I think run through our thoughts and intelligence and disputes and debates.
You know, given that, it reminds me of another chapter. It is astonishing that we all, as children, learn this language. You know, I mean, you lay out the different ways that we can see verbs, your dear friends. You know, that the children can say, all the animals are waked up, or I turned the raining off, meaning a sprinkler, or I hid it in my neck. And we can all think of the way kids say things. And then somewhere, in a very short amount of time, they learn the proper usage. How does that happen?
Well, this is, in fact, how I got into the subject matter covered in the Stuff of Thought originally. I was interested in explaining how children acquire language. A big part of language is the way we use verbs. A verb holds the sentence together. To get back to politics, one of the reasons that everyone perceived Sarah Palin as babbling in her Katie Couric interview is that her utterances had no verbs. That's the difference between talking about something and saying something. When you say something, you need a verb.
Verbs are your friends.
Verbs are my friends, right? And a verb is what makes a sentence say something that is true or false. So a sub-problem in explaining how kids learn language, because it's too complicated to solve all in one fell swoop, is how do they learn the verbs? How do they learn the verbs involves how do they construe events, because the same event can be construed in different ways. A very simple example is you go over to a sink, open the faucet, water goes into the glass, is full. What just happened? You can say that I poured water into the glass. You can say I filled the glass with water. Now, why are those different? Well, notice that their syntax is different. In one case, the direct object of the verb is the water, poured the water. In another case, the direct object is the glass, I filled the glass. Mm. There are thousands of verbs,
sure,
each of which specifies what its object has to be. When we learn a foreign language as an adult, that often is what makes us tear our hair out, learning all of these facts about all of these verbs.
Just to drive it home, you write, you can load hay, or you can load the wagon with hay. Well, you can fill the wagon with hay, but you can't fill
hay into the wagon.
Hay, right,
exactly.
You can't.
So there's three kinds of verbs. There are verbs like pour water into the glass. Verbs like fill the glass with water. Verbs like load, which go both ways. You can either load hay into the wagon or load the wagon
so
with hay.
So how do we know
So
that?
What's going on there? I mean, are these just quirks, just irregularities that you just have to memorize one at a time? Well, the answer is no. They actually involve different ways of construing the event. Now, when you put that water in the glass, you can think of it as doing two things. you can be doing something to the glass, namely causing it to go from empty to full, or you're doing something to the water. You're causing it to go into the glass. Now, neither one is right or wrong. They're just two ways of conceptualizing what is affected. And I harped on that example because it's so simple. I mean, it's just moving some liquid somewhere. If the mind is flexible enough to think of that in two different ways, just think of the explosion of possibilities when it gets to invading Iraq versus liberating Iraq, or socializing medicine versus providing health care to all. A lot of our arguments, our law, our philosophy consists of taking an event where everyone agrees what happened, but conceptualizing it in two different ways.
Steven Pinker, professor of psychology at Harvard. His latest book, just out in paperback, is The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. Steven, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And still to come today, someone who calls that big bill neither a bailout or a rescue, but communism. That's still to come after the news here and now. We go to politics, where some Democratic strategists are now cautiously predicting that the economic crisis could lead to a landslide victory for Barack Obama. The Politico reports that four battleground states that Republican John McCain seemed likely to win, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, and Ohio, are now leaning towards Obama. McCain can't win the White House if he loses any of them. And voters at a McCain campaign event yesterday in heavily Republican Waukesha, Wisconsin, were frustrated and angry, including this African-American radio host.
Sir, I believe that in the next coming debate, it is absolutely vital that you take it to Obama, that you hit him where it hits. It's a soft call. Sir, Acorn is out there. We have the good Reverend Wright. We have all of these shady characters that have surrounded him. We have corruption here in Wisconsin and voting across the nation. I am begging you, sir.
But despite that, today in La Crosse, Wisconsin, McCain limited his criticism of Obama to Obama's policies. In a few minutes, we're going to go to Ohio, where Obama is campaigning. But first to Wisconsin. McCain is trying to flip that state to his column, to the Republican column, but polls now show Obama with a 5 to 10 point lead. Greg Borowski is political reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Greg, it seemed as if people in the audience there really want to hear more about issues like Jeremiah Wright. People were chanting Obama, socialist. What do they want McCain to do?
Well, thanks for having me on. I believe the forum, the town hall forum yesterday in Waukesha showed really was some of the frustration or anxiety among the Republican Party base. The county of Waukesha is the strongest Republican county in terms of size and intensity in the state in most elections. And the folks there were really pushing Senator McCain and Governor Palin to be more aggressive, to bring out a lot of the things that they've been reluctant to discuss or only discussing, you know, sort of around the edges, you know, Reverend Wright, Acorn.
Well, let's talk about Acorn. Talk about Acorn, because people in the audience were angrily shouting out Acorn. This is the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, longtime community activist group which also does voter registration. On their way into the event, these Wisconsin Republicans were handing out flyers reading, "Your vote is being stolen." Now, let's remind people, Acorn is being investigated for some of its voter registration. Acorn says it self-reported the few fraudulent registrations. It has fired workers who violated the rules. How do you expect this to be played out? Because it's certainly playing out on a lot of talk radio, and we're certainly hearing from McCain supporters. They want to hear more about it.
Well, it's certainly an issue here in Wisconsin for two reasons. One, the state was so exceedingly close 4 years ago. It was, you know, won by Senator Kerry by less than a half a percentage point. And there were a lot of concerns then about various potential fraudulent activities, you know, felons who had voted inappropriately and so forth. And secondly, Acorn here in the city of Milwaukee has faced some criticism and is some potential charges of the same sort of cases of folks who were submitting fraudulent voter applications. A lot of these cases are waiting for charges from the district attorney's office, some for related. The Community Voter Project group have already been charged. So I think those sort of cases intensify that issue here for voters.
Well, the Capital Times associate editor and columnist John Nichols, a longtime politics watcher in Wisconsin, says the real problem in Wisconsin is that McCain hasn't had a clear message. He's been less organized, and that the mean attack image is hurting him. Now, we've heard people, you know, in the crowd saying they want to hear more about issues like Acorn. They want to hear him attack Obama. But, you know, here's a political watcher saying that's actually hurting him. What's your sense?
Well, I mean, that's always a backlash someone risks down the stretch here, especially when you're trying to appeal to the independent swing voters. I mean, Senator McCain, I think, has felt he's had a decent chance to win Wisconsin. He's has more of a, the state has sort of a maverick reputation. You know, it goes after folks who are independent-minded thinkers. Senator Proxmire comes to mind from years ago. So I think he's felt like he could do a good job here. The question is, if you're appealing to those swing voters who are turned off by some of the negative attacks, but the base is pushing those attacks, and you want to keep the base fired up. So it's really kind of a delicate balancing act he faces.
Greg, thanks so much.
You're quite welcome.
Greg Borowski, political reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We want to touch down in the battleground state of Ohio as well. That's where Barack Obama is campaigning for a second day in a row. Joe Froelich is associate editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Joe, first of all, how do you hear, you know, the chants on the McCain trail reverberating at all in Ohio? Are people demanding to know more about Acorn?
Well, you're hearing the same sort of thing, Robin, that Greg referred to in Wisconsin, and I think you'll hear it around the country from the people who go to the rallies, who tend to sort of be the true believers, who are plugged into the some of the conservative websites and the talk radio where this issue is really getting a lot of traction. I tend to think for the average swing voter, that person, independent, that it's a that they really both need to win in a state like Ohio. I think that's a real inside baseball kind of thing, particularly the Acorn issue, which is kind of confusing.
Well, and I'm wondering, and others are wondering, if in fact that's perhaps why it's being these flames are being fanned right now. Republicans were asked on a conference call yesterday if these voter fraud allegations would affect the outcome in November. Were they asked if they were setting up a fight if the election is close?
Well, I think that's always a possibility. I mean, frankly, both parties do that. They mobilize their legions of lawyers, and they kind of look around early on. And I think it's now becoming more public, something that, say, back in 2000 might have been more of a behind-the-scenes thing about where do we think the fight's going to be. There is an effort to play. Both sides in Ohio, I think, now have tried to play sort of on the integrity of the system. We've got a pretty partisan Democratic Secretary of State who replaced a very partisan Republican Secretary of State. So I think it's easy for both parties to try to say, look, the other guys are trying to pull something over here.
And why is the race so close in Ohio? I mean, I'm wondering, what are the issues, you know, that haven't allowed people to go over into the Obama camp the way they have in other states, or, you know, haven't allowed them to go fully into the McCain camp?
Well, I think Ohio's a very, very closely divided state. It was decided last time by about 118,000 votes. Most of the rule of thumb in all the years I've been writing about politics in Ohio is you've got about 40% of the people who will vote for any plausible breathing Democrat, and 40% of the people who will vote for any plausible, you know, breathing Republican. And you got 20% of the people who are up for grabs in any given election. And I'm not sure that either of them have particularly connected as well as they need to. Obama did not do very well here in the primary. At one point, it was considered very, very close, but Hillary Clinton beat him in a landslide in the end. Parts of the southern parts of the state, really, she ran up huge margins against him. He's only beginning, I think, to catch on there. That's where he's actually been campaigning the last 2 days. He hasn't been up here in northern Ohio.
Huh.
Sort of the traditional Democratic hotbed. He's been working areas where both he did very poorly in the primary and where John Kerry did not do very well 4 years ago. You know, John McCain's clearly running against the economic issue, because this has been a very hard hit state economically. And I think there's also, you know, I'm sure there's some frustration because he's the kind of Republican who's traditionally done pretty well in Ohio,
right.
That kind of moderate Republican. So.
Joe Froelich, associate editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, touching down in Ohio for us today. Joe, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And we've been speaking of voting. Just want to give you a reminder. On Monday, we're going to talk about the history of voting. At least today, we don't have to bring our own ballots, as you're going to hear on Monday. You're listening to Here and Now. Have you seen the full-page ads? Caricatures of President Bush, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke. In one, they're all in military uniform atop a mountain, pushing a flag into the ground like those World War II troops during the Battle of Iwo Jima. Wait a minute, though. The flag features a hammer and sickle and the words Big Insurance, Detroit Auto, and Wall Street Banks. Might someone be expressing anger at the Wall Street bailout? Yes, several times over, in fact, in full-page ads in the New York Times. Bill Perkins is founder and manager of the Houston venture capital firm Small Ventures USA. He calls the $700 billion rescue package trickle-down communism. He joins us now. And, Bill, tell us how you really feel about the bailout bill.
I think the ad crystallizes my thoughts well. I think we've abandoned some core principles of the United States of America, and we've basically have this kind of trickle-down communism, trickle-down socialism going on.
Well, we understand these ads you've bought are $139,000 apiece, and that you're paying for them out of money that you made recently when you bought Goldman Sachs stocks as they were plummeting, with news of the bad assets tied up in mortgages. We all know about that. And then you, in effect, bet that those stocks would rise after news of the bailout, and they did. You sold them at a profit. So you made over $1 million on the bailout. Do you feel guilty about it? Is that part of your protest?
I felt kind of disgusted. You know, I was raised not to steal, and I felt like the government was stealing for guys like me, for rich guys like
me. Stealing for you. Yeah.
I mean, right now we're turning the Federal Reserve and the Treasury into the biggest welfare organization in the world, except the beneficiaries are a bunch of rich guys in Wall Street banks.
Well, you know, let's just review what the thinking is, that in bailing out those, fat cats, the bill is supposed to loosen credit so the little guy in Main Street can get a loan to make payroll. We understand Iceland is going under. There's just not enough liquidity, and governments have to infuse banks with cash or buy these bad assets from investment houses to get them off the markets so that the little guy in Main Street can get a loan.
I don't buy it. And there wasn't really any debate on whether that's a realistic threat. You know, the little guy is insured up to $100,000 in each account.
That's in banks.
Yeah, in the bank. Okay, so his money's not disappearing, right? And you're worrying about whether they get loans. But we basically have been led by fear and intimidation, not by logic and reason. So that's a discussion that needed to happen before they passed this bill, not after.
Have I read you also say that, you know, if people make, you know, bought bad mortgages and, you know, gotten into trouble, well, you know, they need to get themselves out of trouble. Are you in that camp as well?
Well, yeah. If you're a trader, basically you're bailing out investment banks. They bought mortgages and bad debt and they're worthless. That's their fault.
Well, what are people who actually, you know, bought the homes? You're talking about the bankers who bought these securitized mortgages after they get bundled up. But what about the people who were, you know, we're hearing stories of people who were really scammed into buying these mortgages, along with there are people who were arrogant enough that they thought they could live above their means. But, I mean, you know, again, are you talking about the fat cats, but isn't this bailout supposed to trickle down to the people who are trying to pay these mortgages?
Well, I can tell you one thing. The bailout does nothing for the people trying to pay their mortgages as it stands right now. Potentially, with the expanded powers of the Fed and the Treasury, there could be some help for the people who are scammed. But that's another issue of whether or not people were following the laws and regulations on the books when they were doing predatory lending practices, which there are already laws and regulations on the books for that, and whether or not we need to bail out the banks. I think commingling those two issues in order to sell us this bill is one of the horrible things that are going on in Congress.
Well, Bill Perkins, you hosted a fundraiser for candidate Barack Obama. He voted for the bailout bill. What would you want to say to him?
I would say that he's horribly wrong on the issue, and he's not understanding the greater implications of this bailout bill. Now everybody has their hand out, and rightfully so. If you're going to bail out this industry, why didn't I get bailed out? Well, why doesn't California get $7 billion? If you're going to give it to the GE Auto guy, why is it this guy? The mentality of America has changed overnight from a what can I do for my country, how can I help myself, to what you're going to do for me.
Well, Bill, you know, in times of crisis, we're all Venezuelans.
I hope not.
Bill Perkins of the Texas venture capital firm Small Ventures USA. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Look, you gotta laugh. And in fact, we'll do a little more of that in just a minute with Saturday Night Live. And also shipping containers and homes in one minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Though the construction industry is slumping, one area is growing: green or environmentally friendly building with solar panels, recycled materials, less energy. A recent survey by the Green Building Council and McGraw-Hill Construction says some 330,000 homes with green features have been built in the U.S. in the past 3 years, representing a $36 billion a year industry. Well, on a trip to California, here and now's Emiko Tamagawa discovered a home where recycled materials are key.
In the hills of Richmond, California, just north of San Francisco, a new home is being christened and shown off. While kids play outside, the adults place their shoes in neat rows by the front door so as not to mar the shiny wood floors and fresh carpeting. Nearby, proud owners Jan Grugier and Patty Boucher greet their guests.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a long time coming.
And it was so cheap. You're still laughing. That's good.
Still laughing, okay. Yes. When you're a pioneer, the first person doing something, it's never going to be cheap.
Jan says he and Patty have dubbed the house Casa Verdanta.
Casa, of course, is house. Verde is green, Spanish green. And Vedanta is actually a Hindu word, which means basically the end or the completion of knowledge. So in a sense, it's sort of like our completion of being a green construction.
What makes Casa Verdanta green and Jan and Patty pioneers are the three insulated shipping containers that are the linchpin of their compact 1,350-square-foot home, the same kind of containers you see at a train depot or port. Patty and Jan agreed to the unconventional design after consulting with their architects. Patty, who calls herself Boss Lady, had just one requirement.
I told them, I said, if you can make a home that is airy and light, and when people drive down the street, they don't see shipping containers, they see a house, then we'd go for it.
And airy and light Casa Verdanta is. The first thing you notice is the large atrium living room, two stories high and with a bank of windows that offer a spectacular view of the surrounding hills. On one side of the atrium, you'll find a simple kitchen and dining room. On the other side, a large den. A stairway leads up to a bridge which spans the two second-floor bedrooms. All the rooms feel spare and clean. The walls and ceilings don't close in on you as you enter. But how did the designers get around the fact that, essentially, they were working with big, long boxes? Architect Kate Leisure explains.
The way we did it is, on the lower levels, we were able to open the walls up to the two-story space in the middle, so there's that sense of coziness and openness between the container and the living room space. And then upstairs, we're able to kind of ameliorate the long and narrowness of the container by putting bay windows in the bedrooms, and that really helped a lot. And also just adding windows, just generally, to the containers really opens them up and makes them feel much nicer.
But why use shipping containers? For architect Kate Leisure and her partner Carl Wanaselia, it's part of the philosophy of their business.
We're always searching about for salvage materials to work with in our practice. And there's a huge pileup of shipping containers in the our ports around the country because the U.S. is such a huge net importer of goods. The containers have a insulation on the walls that's a little better than what's the minimum required for houses out here, and the floor as well. And the roof is not quite as good as the insulation that's required in California. And so it actually works really well because we put a roof on top of the second-story container, and it creates a nice overhang, a nice eave, and we added the insulation, the extra insulation that way.
To realize the architect's plan, the owners sought out structural engineer Bruce King.
I was asked because I have a bit of a reputation as an engineer willing to do unusual things. I've written books on straw bale construction and earthen construction and using industrial waste products to make concrete. So I was kind of the natural magnet for a weird job like this.
King says shipping containers have been used by militaries around the world for construction, but that didn't mean that turning them into Casa Verdanta was easy or cheap.
There are technical problems. As an engineer, I had to get familiar with the metals and how these things were made and all of that. There were governmental hurdles. You know, we had to get a permit and had spent some time talking to the building officials and getting them familiar with it because they had never seen it before. And then there are construction problems because all the tradesmen, the electrician, the plumber, the painter, everybody, they'd never worked with this before, so they had to learn. And whenever you have that, it adds cost to a job because it slows people down and they have to sit there and scratch their heads. But all that said, once you've done a couple of them, you know how to do it.
It's one thing to build a house like this in Northern California with its moderate climate. But would shipping container homes work in places with more wicked weather?
Of course. You're either keeping heat in or keeping heat out. How you do that in Boston is not really that different than how you do it in San Francisco. It's more extreme in Boston because it gets colder and hotter. But the basic principles still apply. So, yeah, I think it would be very applicable anywhere in the world, in the tropics, in the Arctic, anywhere.
And that's owner Patty Boucher's dream, despite the fact that her project, being a kind of learn-as-you-go experience, cost more than she anticipated. When I asked her whether or not other people should follow in her footsteps, she didn't hesitate.
Yes, I would recommend finding alternative ways and reusing and recycling and reducing as much as you can. There's plenty of things that you can build from rather than cutting down trees.
Our visit to Casa Verdanta was produced by Here Now's Emiko Tamagawa. To see pictures of the house and for more information, please go to our website, here-now.org. Okay, there is one group of people laughing this week, the cast of Saturday Night Live. In fact, they have so many laughs, they've annexed Thursday night. And in last night's Saturday Night Live Weekend Update Thursday, they took on this week's presidential debate with faux candidates wandering in front of the camera, blocking the moderator's view. But it was the economy that gave them the most material. In fact, they've created new news segments to try to express the extent of the bad news. The really? You've got to be kidding. And oh my God news. Here's Amy Poehler and Seth Meyers talking about the report earlier this week that executives from AIG, just recently bailed out by taxpayers, took a retreat in Southern California.
You went on this retreat only 6 days after receiving an $85 billion bailout? Really? Even the mafia knows not to spend money that soon after a heist. I mean, really?
Really? And the retreat was planned to recognize AIG's top earners. Really? What does it take to be a top earner at AIG right now? Did you sell your office furniture on Craigslist?
I mean, really?
Really?
And you spent $150,000 on banquets? Really? Was your waiter Prince? Did you hire robot chefs? You better have hired robot chefs, because if there are any humans in the kitchen, you drank urine.
Yeah, you did. Really? You really did. Really. And you defended the retreat, saying it had been planned before the bailout. That's like going ahead with Grandma's birthday party, even though Grandma died 3 days ago.
Really? And really, you had to go there for team building? Here's a cheaper way to do team building. You know all those empty sacks that used to be filled with money? Get in those and race.
Yeah. Really?
Really.
Also, really, the Federal Reserve on Wednesday agreed to provide AIG with a second $37 billion loan on top of the original $85 billion
really?
Loan. Yeah. Which brings us to a new segment that we like to call... Oh, my God, are you serious?
I'm really serious.
Oh, my God. It's like you gave your junkie cousin $100 for rent, and then you ran into him at the dog track, and you gave him another $37 billion. I mean, oh, my God, are you serious?
Seriously, are you serious?
Oh, my God.
Really?
Huh.
An excerpt from last night's Saturday Night Live Weekend Update Thursday, the really oh, my God news. We might have to steal that. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great week, and we'll be here for you on Columbus Day, so please join us here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.